Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books Network and your host, Nathan Moore, are honored to interview Professor Curtis Runstedler on his book, Alchemy and Exemplary Poetry in Middle English Literature. Dr. Curtis Runstedler is a postdoctoral researcher in English literature and cultures at the University of Stuttgart, and his current research examines literary depictions of robots and AI in contemporary literature, and his PhD is in English literature and was conferred at Durham University in 2018. Dr. Runstedler, enlighten your audience more about your research interests and how you came to study these topics.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. So I've always been interested in the intersection between literature and science as far back as I can remember. My dad studied biochemistry and my grandfather studied he was a lab technician in a chemistry lab. So I've always kind of been interested in those intersections. So astronomy, alchemy, astrology, to a lot of the medieval sciences as well. And I did my master's at Durham University in England on werewolves in the medieval romance. So I guess that kind of got me thinking about, you know, where does the science end and where does the magic begin? Because as we know, in the Middle Ages, a lot of times magic and science overlap too. So it got me into kind of science and literature. I did my PhD on alchemy and Middle English poetry, so medieval English poetry. And I really enjoyed doing that too. I wanted to do more astronomy at the time too, but you know, there's only so much time, right? So yeah, I was kind of interested in what kind of connect them together, how we can do kind of science better, what kind of, not only, you know, alchemy is the prototype for chemistry or whatever the case may be, but also how we can look at these medieval poems and what they can tell us about science in the time, or how we can learn more about pseudoscience or the history of science from these poems. I was also really interested too the relationship between medieval science and magic too. Where does one end and one begin? So that was also something that I was kind of looking at a lot. And I began kind of looking at medieval astronomy, and I realized it was kind of too much to take on before I looked at medieval alchemy too. And medieval alchemy, there's a lot of really interesting poems that we know about already, such as Geoffrey Chaucer's Canon's Yeoman's Tale in the Canterbury Tales. And this is about a kind of a story within a story too. So I started off with the kind of poems that we know about. His contemporary John Gower also writes about alchemy, but there's also a lot of stuff that people haven't really looked at too. So a lot of 15th century poems containing kind of what I call alchemical recipes. And those are kind of short excerpts about alchemy too. There's some really interesting dialogues too. So one between Merlin and Merlin and Morienus, who is kind of the father of alchemy. And also another one between Albertus Magnus, of kind of famous German friar, and the Queen of Elves. And obviously, we know that the real life Albertus Magnus, he was a scientist, an early scientist, writing about the earth, and he did write about alchemy, but he was kind of against it. But the Queen of Elves depiction, this is kind of made to kind of bolster the authority of the text too. So there's a lot of really interesting things going on there too. It's kind of a whole wormhole of discovery and interesting aspects.
Would you agree that your book is about magic, or is it more about science?
I think, as I said too, I think there's a lot of overlap between the two in the text. So you could say technically it's about both. I think my book in particular is more about the science, I think, behind it too. It's a history of science too. So we know nowadays, obviously, that alchemy doesn't work, you know, the transmutation of base metals into gold. So something like copper or tin transmuting into gold, that doesn't work too. I mean, with a lot of, science technology, you can kind of technically transmute, you know, lead into gold. But yeah, I would say it's more about science too. It's about history of science. And it's also looking at literature primarily too. It's a literature text too. Also medieval history too. So there's something kind of in it for everyone too. It's a very interdisciplinary approach to the topic too. Also some philosophy, also some kind of metaphysics too, Aristotelian metaphysics. So yeah, a lot of kind of medieval philosophy in it as well.
Why did you decide to research the medieval study of alchemy and not some other field?
Yeah, so that was really interesting. So obviously it was a little bit different than my master's, you know, writing about medieval werewolves. But yeah, I've always kind of been interested in the occult kind of sciences too, in the Middle Ages too. And what's interesting about alchemy is that people were always interested in it, yet it was never really considered a legitimate science by a lot of practitioners. A lot of the practitioners who did legitimize it, they kind of tried to connect to Christ to kind of give it more authority too. So I was really kind of interested in that too, you know, because alchemy, obviously it doesn't work, as I've said too, but it lays a lot of the groundwork for modern chemistry too. So yeah, I was kind of interested in that too. And I was thinking, you know, what can these poems tell us about early science? What can we do with these poems too? You know, they're not just poems too, but they also connect to an exemplary tradition too. So, you know, how do these poets use these poems to make moral points about practice and scientific practice too? So not only, you know, for the benefit of the artist, but also how scientists can look at these poems and find meaning in that too, how artists can look in these poems and find meaning too, and just kind of examining that kind of intersection as well.
And is it only poetry, or do you also write about lengthy prose?
More poetry I looked at too. So a lot of the excerpts that I had too, there was a lot of kind of Latin prose too, some Middle English prose, but mostly it was poetry that I looked at too. Obviously, I didn't look at all the manuscripts. There's a lot of good stuff too, but I tried to show examples of how it connects to this exempla tradition. And what the exempla tradition is, these were kind of secular stories in the late Middle Ages too, and they'd be used to prove a moral point. And what my book is doing is connecting that exempla tradition to medieval science, so alchemy, and also to the medieval poetry that's being produced too. And what we see going into the 14th, 15th centuries too is not only alchemy becoming more and more popular, and it'll get even more popular going into the Renaissance with Queen Elizabeth too. She had her own practitioner, but I don't get into that in this book too. There's a very exciting time for these things. There's a lot of stuff being produced, and I hope that answers your question.
Are you arguing against the work of other literary scholars or refuting any arguments? And what is your thesis?
So I do challenge some literary scholars too. Some of them, you know, a lot of times some of the authors that I look at, such as John Gower, they kind of get, they have a less than favorable reputation. Thankfully, a lot of the John Gower scholarship that's coming out today is kind of more favorable, but there's an alchemical passage in his book too. So he's a contemporary of Chaucer. His stuff gets kind of overlooked, I think, a lot of times too. So it's nice to shine new light on this too. So I wouldn't say I'm refuting any kind of scholars too, but what I am doing is kind of linking it to that exempla tradition, and I don't really think that's been done so much before. One of my contemporaries, Owen Bentick, who just published a book, Literatures of Alchemy, I think it's with Boyle and Brewer, that just came out as well too. It's a very good book too. Him and I used to present at conferences a lot together, and he's kind of looking at more kind of the vernacular tradition as well too. But I think as far as I know, I'm the only one looking at it from an exempla perspective, so linking exempla and science and poetry too. So that's my argument too. So I'm saying that these medieval poems can be read as exempla for kind of different aspects. So, you know, how to practice science better, how to kind of be a better person, essentially, too. So raising a lot of different moral points about what they can mean and what they can be. I do refute Carl Jung, though. I forgot to mention that, too. And I think that leads us to the next question as well, right?
Yes, I was going to mention Carl Jung's theories. What was it about them that you were not in agreement with?
Yeah, so obviously Carl Jung is a great great mind, you know, coming from Freud to one of the great minds of the 19th century. I love a lot of Carl Jung's alchemical theories. I don't agree with it in practice, too, because so my research is really connected, too, with a lot of the in the early 20th century, they had what was called Ambic's Journal. And this was the journal of the Society for the History of Chemistry and Alchemy. And it was, you know, started by F. Sherwood Taylor, a lot of these old kind of old white guys. And they basically argued that, you know, alchemy was a worthwhile, the history of alchemy was a worthwhile study. They really want to focus on this too, but they also recognize that alchemy has a practical dimension too. So it's not just symbolic too, you know, there was a practical dimension. I mean, we found traces at Cambridge University of old alchemical laboratories, so really interesting. And the reason why I refute Jung, as much as I like Jung, is that his alchemical stuff is all linked to kind of dream theory and it's linked to symbolism, which is fine. But I think there always runs a risk to, you know, if you can't read everything as alchemical, right? You know, it has a practical dimension as too, you know, was being practiced in the workshops. A lot of these poets who are writing, some of them we don't know about, they're anonymous writers, but ones like Chaucer and John Gower in the 14th century too, we do know that they probably weren't practicing alchemists, right? So they were kind of, I guess you would say, armchair alchemists too. And I think that's the same with Carl Jung too. He was a psychologist by nature, which is fine. But again, you know, I don't think you can read everything as alchemical. So that was the point I was trying to make with that.
You cite various authors from the medieval period and writers. But who do you want the New Books Network to know about the most?
Well, I think they're all important. I don't I don't want one to kind of step over the other ones, too. I think everyone knows about Chaucer, but they might not know so much about his contemporary, John Gower, too, who wrote The Confessio Mantis. But John Gower is also special because he wrote, he was a trilingual poet, so he wrote the Miroir de l'Homme. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. That's a French text. And he also wrote Vox Clementis, which was a Latin text, so he could speak Latin, French, and English. And I actually look at the French text as well, too. I also look at John Lydgate, too. So John Lydgate was writing in the 15th century. He was a monk, and he kind of gets looked down upon a little bit in history, too, because he was very prolific in his time, but he was also... He wrote so much that a lot of times people think, you know, his writing is quite dry too. I look at one of his shorter poems, The Churl and the Bird, because there's a manuscript at the British Library, Harley Manuscript 2407. This is a really interesting manuscript and it's full of alchemical recipes and details too. And they actually have a alchemical version of his poem. Just they have his poem and they have like a couple additional stanzas that make it more alchemical. They talk about, the anonymous poet talks about Alexander the Great, and the bird is supposed to represent this alchemical Hermes bird, which is really interesting too. And then in the last chapter of the book, I look at two alchemical dialogues. One's from a Cambridge manuscript and another's from the Oxford manuscript. One is between Albertus Magnus and the Queen of Elves, and the other one is between Merlin and Morienus, who I said is the kind of father of alchemy too. And it's not the Merlin we kind of picture, you know, when you think of Merlin, you think of the long beard and the pointy hat, but this is actually a child Merlin too. So it's kind of a father teaching alchemy to his son too, but it's very allegorical too. So obviously, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of these anonymous poets' names, but thanks to a lot of the Renaissance works, a lot of times, you know, in the Renaissance period, a lot of these authors were kind of again, looking down on the Middle Ages too, but some, you know, you had some antiquarians like, I think the great one was Elias Ashmole, who was based in Oxford too. And he wrote Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum in 1652. And his compendium is really important too. It has all kinds of different alchemical texts, because not only does he include early modern texts, but a lot of medieval texts too. So all the ones I mentioned basically are included in there too, except for the Albertus Magnus and the Queen of Elves one too. But he has Chaucer, Gower. And it's a really interesting point for thinking about how, you know, people in the early modern period were thinking about the Middle Ages too. And that's another part of my research that I'm really interested in too, is how are these kind of Renaissance writers and antiquarians thinking about the medieval past too? Because a lot of times they have erroneous information. Chaucer, for example, he thought Gower was Chaucer's alchemical master. So we know that's not true. But it kind of, it's a really interesting way of approaching it too, and trying to get past obviously the Victorian lens of seeing the medieval past too. But yeah, I would say kind of Chaucer, Gower, John Lydgate, and Elias Ashmole. I'm quite a feminist too, so unfortunately there's not very many female alchemists. I wish there was more. There's an early account of someone called Mary the Jewess in classical times, and she informed Zosimos of Panopolis too, who was a Greek alchemist too. We don't really know much about Mary, but she is known for kind of her contributions to the apparatuses of alchemy. But yeah, I would say those are the big names. So Chaucer, Gower, John Lydgate, and probably Elias Ashmole.
The term exempla or exemplary poetry, what does it mean?
So the term exempla, it means an example basically too. So it's it's a short narrative, and it's usually secular in content too. Really interesting history too. So this actually comes from the Christian tradition too. A lot of contemporary literature would include the Gesta Romanorum, that sort of thing too. And what I'm arguing here in my research is that these alchemical poems are actually can be read as exempla or singular exemplum. It starts kind of in the 14th century too. We kind of see this emergence, more interest in the kind of vernacular alchemical poetry, and going into the 15th century. And so this kind of links together with the two. And as I said too, it links all the way back to the New Testament too, with Jesus talking about, you know, using a lot of parables in his speech too. And then, you know, Gregory the Great kind of appropriates it a bit more too. And then as we go further into the Middle Ages, we have the growth of kind of more secular exempla too. And they're usually used to make a moral purpose too, you know, for enlightenment or making one's life better too. And I suggest that these connect to these poems too. And what I'd also be interested in looking at too is seeing if it applies to other kind of sciences as well, you know, alchemy, astrology too. Very ambitious, but you know, it was fun to start with alchemy.
Is alchemical writing structurally different from other sources of literature, like the cadence or the syntax, especially in poetry? What was alchemical writing meant to do, and is it creating some kind of emotional response?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Obviously, with a lot of the later texts too, like the alchemical recipes. So what an alchemical recipe is kind of like what you think about today. So medieval cooking is a little bit different. So in Middle Ages, they didn't really have like measurements for the recipes, which sounds crazy, but that's how they did it. But it would kind of be a recipe too, and a lot of the times it'd be in the form of a narrative too. So you'd have kind of one person with all the knowledge, so the Queen of Elves telling Albertus Magnus how to make the tincture or the philosopher's stone or the elixir of life, the elixir vitae. I forgot the question. What was the question again? Sorry.
Is alchemical writing structurally different from other kinds of literature?
Right. In some ways, I think the shorter ones too, they kind of had a certain meter too, and rhyming scheme too. So a lot of times if you were a practitioner, if you were working in a workshop or something too, you could read these poems as a way of memorizing the ingredients and they do use a lot of ciphers too. So a lot of times, you know, it'd be kind of impenetrable, a lot of these alchemical secrets. And this is what John Gower is saying too. You know, the ancients were successful with alchemy, but nowadays people are kind of too stupid to know the alchemical secrets too. the different authors that I look at, they approach alchemy a little bit differently. So in the Confessio Mentis, the John Gower chapter, this is more encyclopedic too, whereas Chaucer's is more of a narrative within a narrative. So in Chaucer's Canon's Yeoman's Tale, it takes place a little bit later in the Canterbury Tales towards the end. And you have a canon and a yeoman, and they kind of come a little bit late to the party too. They're getting closer to St. Thomas, and the canon's yeoman doesn't shut up, so he's going on and on, and then he tells everyone how bad the canon's been to him and how much his alchemical experiments have failed, and then the canon runs off, and then the second part of the story you get the actual story. So he tells his story, and he tells about this kind of basically snake oil salesman canon who goes around ripping people off, and he rips off this chantry priest, and it's a great short story. It's one of my favorite Canterbury Tales too. But that one also uses obviously the iambic pentameter too, the same as Shakespeare. But then we have a lot of the later poems that I look at later on too. They have kind of a different rhyming scheme too. But obviously the rhyming scheme is important too, and I think that's a good kind of mnemonic signifier for helping people who are reading it to understand the content.
How can we chart the migration of alchemical ideas from Europe or into Europe from other places?
Yes, that's a great question. So obviously it didn't come directly. Really interesting history too. So a lot of it started off in Hellenic Egypt too. So during the Greek times, it was really developed there too. We had Zosimos of Panopolis, who I mentioned, Mary the Jewess too. And then a lot of it was lost to Europe after the Greeks. And the Arabic world and the Persian world, they're very different than they are now too. They were really interested in science and kind of a lot of activities too. So that they were interested in kind of ophthalmology and alchemy and astronomy, a lot of kind of pioneering things, you know, medieval robots. And they translated a lot of the texts from the Greek too, and at this time it wasn't available to the Europeans. And then it came to the Western world through kind of a lot of centers such as Toledo, and Robert of Chester, he was successful in translating it into Latin too, and that kind of sparked a lot of the interest in the West too, and people became really interested in it too, and it was always challenged too. So Pope John the 22nd, he had a decretal against alchemists too, because there was always the risk that you could, you know, ruin the currency too if it was successful too. But nobody was ever really successful with alchemy. And then a lot of times the practicing alchemists would link it to Christian allegory to try and legitimize it too. And then in the late Middle Ages too, you know, before Paracelsus's time, you had a lot of people trying to link it to medicine too. So alchemy having medicinal purposes, trying to heal the sick king, that sort of thing too. So it was always challenged, but it was always there and always being interested too. And then obviously as it became more known in Europe, it kind of picked up too. So it was always kind of popular once it arrived.
The Philosopher's Stone and Hermes are popular topics for people interested in the Emerald Tablet. Do you write about Hermes in the Emerald Tablet?
Yeah, I do actually. So that's a really interesting one too. And there's a lot of kind of pseudo history tales of Alexander the Great finding the Emerald Tablet and that sort of thing too. And you know, we can probably disprove that obviously. But I do write about the Philosopher's Stone too. It is kind of mentioned in a lot of these alchemical narratives too, because that's the end goal too. So alchemy has two main goals. Medieval alchemy, at least, too. You have a transmutation of base metal into gold, and then also the search for the elixir vitae, and the elixir vitae is meant to prolong the user's life too. So it's not supposed to be eternal. The stone, the making of the Philosopher's Stone. So the stone is a transmuting agent to replicate gold, and this is something that's been very popularized in obviously Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. I think the American title is Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and what the hell's a Sorcerer's Stone? We don't know, because I think the Macmillan wanted a better title for their audience. They didn't know if people would know what the Philosopher's Stone is, but then it kind of loses its meaning too, right? Yeah, I think this comes up a lot in my research too. I mean, all the characters in the texts are searching for that Philosopher's Stone, whether for good or bad too. Hermes comes up too. Hermes is kind of Trismegistus too. He's kind of this legendary kind of Greek figure too. Hermes threefold. And I also talk about Hermes bird too. So Hermes bird is an allegorical figure too. She appears as a bird in the Churl and the Bird story, but she's also supposed to represent Mercury too, with capital M. So not the not the substance, the material philosophical principle. So you have Mercury and sulfur, and in the Middle Ages that was believed to be the theory to combine to create the Philosopher's Stone, but nobody was really successful with that either too. So yeah, it's kind of recurring throughout a lot of my things too. So it's kind of a search for a Philosopher's Stone, and what J.K. Rowling was doing with it is really interesting too. I talk about that a little bit in my introduction too. You know, Harry Potter actually gets the Philosopher's Stone because he's, you know, a good person. He wants to use it for selfless ends, whereas Voldemort and Quirrell want to get it, that Philosopher's Stone, but for kind of immoral ends too, so they don't really end up getting it too. And they have that scene in the film where he touches them and kind of they disintegrate.
And what alchemical themes do you think are most important for researchers today who are looking at alchemy for literature or history?
I think it's important to recognize historically the kind of the stigmas maybe around it too. I mean, alchemy could be quite dangerous too. I mean, they didn't have the same lab safety equipment that a lot of chemists have, you know, today too. It could be quite dangerous. You know, if you're putting the wrong ingredients in, it could explode. You could die basically. And there was also kind of the spiritual dangers too. You know, if you practice alchemy, you might summon demons. Maybe it's demonic agency too. You know, what is God's will and what is kind of demonic too. But I think nowadays, I think it's important to recognize, how it links to kind of chemical study today as well, too. So a lot of the apparatuses too, maybe a lot of the methodologies, I think too. But also, you know, how we think about science too. And, you know, I think a lot of times we look at things like science or chemistry too, from a scientific perspective, but we don't really consider the artistic perspective. There's not kind of a symbiosis between them two. And something I'd really like to do is kind of nurture kind of more of a symbiosis between them, just to kind of encourage kind of a dialogue even between two, because I think art has a lot to teach science. And I think scientists could teach a lot about art. And I think depicting kind of alchemical poems as narratives too is a really interesting way of expressing ideas about art and science too. So I think there's something there for everyone in that regard.
And do Masonic orders or Templars make it into your book?
Not so much, unfortunately. I'd love to talk about that stuff. But the history of that didn't really figure too much too. In the 14th century, we get more kind of like courtly poets writing about alchemy too, but obviously the readership increases too. By the time we get to the 15th century, you know, we get people from across the social classes and social orders reading about alchemy too. So everyone, not just people of the court, you had worksmen, craftsmen, you know, painters reading about these alchemical recipes too, not just monks kind of holed up in some library. I didn't encounter the Templar too much in my research, or the Mason orders. I think maybe the Mason orders come up a little bit later in the Renaissance period too, and you have a lot of stuff like the Rosicrucians too. Elias Ashmole was a Rosicrucian too. This is the I think it's the Rosy Cross. I think that's the translation too. So I do mention that a little bit too, but for the most part, a lot of that isn't mentioned so much. Although it's really interesting too. I'd love to hear more about the kind of medieval manifestations of it. Maybe might be something for a future article.
Would you think of Francis Bacon or Thomas More to be alchemical writers?
That's a tricky one. I haven't really looked at their contributions. I think they were kind of, like, if we look at medieval alchemy, they were kind of really pretty critical of the Middle Ages too. So I wouldn't call him alchemist per se. There was a medieval Franciscan friar named Roger Bacon in the, I think, 13th century. He was based in Oxford too. And he was kind of interested in alchemy a little bit too. He did write about the Philosopher's Stone because he thought that it was valid. But I think in terms of Francis and Thomas More, I don't think they were too alchemical with their interest too. I think a lot of people in the court at that time were kind of casually practicing alchemy, but they were kind of, you know, the very definition of Renaissance man too. They were dabbling in this and dabbling in that. So I'm not too familiar with their practices, but I think Thomas More might have done a little bit of alchemy.
Did you research power structures at all? And there are sections where you talk about and write and have researched on like kings and queens. Queens. Mm-hmm. How do kings and queens make it or influence your research?
Yeah, so that's really important. So a lot of times kings would have control over, you know, the availability and the accessibility of alchemy too. So historically in the 14th and 15th centuries, you had a lot of these practitioners petitioning the kings for licenses because, you know, technically alchemy was outlawed. And a lot of times, I think with Henry the Fifth or Sixth, you know, he was kind of, they were trying to make more medicinal approaches to alchemy so they could appeal him to. I mean, to be honest, I think everyone wanted the money at the end of the day. But they appealed to the king to try and kind of make alchemy more legitimate, I think, as a practice too. And a lot of these people actually were given kind of licenses to practice alchemy, but obviously nothing really came of it too. But again, as I mentioned earlier, it's kind of interesting in that period too, because you see more medicinal kind of proposals to alchemy too. And that really kind of kicks off when we get to the early modern period with Paracelsus, who was a Swiss alchemist too. And the Paracelsian movement. But there wasn't really so many queens at the time. I wrote an article about this on Game of Thrones, actually, for a book chapter. There wasn't so many medieval queens writing about it. It was kind of obviously very patriarchal at the time, too. So it was mostly kings who would have the kind of final say on alchemical commissions. But in the Renaissance period, you have, you know, Queen Elizabeth, you know, patronizing alchemy, too. And it's quite popular in her court. A lot of her you know, people in the court were practicing alchemy. John Dee in particular, too, is kind of a famous figure. Edward Kelly, who were practicing alchemy at that time, too. But in the Middle Ages, it was mostly kind of the kings who were either kind of for alchemy or against it, too. And alchemy is kind of always coming back again. It's kind of like a boomerang, too. So even if they outlaw it, too, you know, people are still practicing it, you know, typical.
AI and automation or robotics, where can we find that inside of your book?
AI and automation don't appear so much in this book too, but this is kind of one of my, I'm starting a new research project with the University of Stuttgart too. But I was really interested in the intersection between early medieval robots and automata and alchemy too. There is kind of a link there too that I have kind of briefly kind of sketched out. So obviously the medieval robots, when we say that phrase, it's not really what we think of today. You know, the Isaac Asimov kind of metallical machine, but in the Middle Ages too, you'd have kind of different things. You'd have like, processions on a cathedral too, or kind of, robots that, croak at a certain time, really interesting mechanical, you know, things driven by pistons and that sort of thing. I think the link there between alchemy and AI and robots is probably the homunculus. And the homunculus is a lab-grown baby, basically, kind of like the medieval Renaissance version of a test tube baby. And the term homunculus, that was a Paracelsian phrase. So I have a term kind of because they do crop up in 15th century manuscripts too. We have kind of these allegories where there is kind of this weird incest, and you get these kind of homunculi or a homunculus, which is interesting too. And I think these have aspects of kind of robots and AI as well too, because they're artificially produced, and it is a form of kind of artificial intelligence. And that's really interesting because a lot of times, you know, when people talk about early AI to they kind of, you know, maybe they'll go back to the Renaissance too. But we do have evidence of it happening in the Middle Ages to the proto-homunculus, as I like to call it, too. So really kind of interesting early example of that.
Is alchemy only a natural process, or can it be artificial?
That's a great debate, actually, because there's in the Middle Ages too, they're always debating whether it's nature, whether it's art. You know, is it art imitating nature, or is it nature? And the some of the poets, Jean de Meung, who writes Romance of the Rose, Roman de la Rose, and Dante writes in the Divine Comedy that you know, it is, they're kind of inferior imitations too. I guess it would depend on who's writing about it too, because that was always the debate too. Is it genuine, or is it just an imitation of nature too? And obviously everyone wanted the real thing too. And I think part of the appeal of alchemy too is it accelerates a process too. You know, when we think of technology today, why is it useful for us? You know, if we think of Tinder, for example, Tinder accelerates a process too. It gives us more matches in less time too. So much like alchemy too, you know, you have the gold produced in less time to so you can kind of a get rich quick scheme, so to speak.
Can you also give the audience an overview of the difference between secular and religious alchemy?
Yes, absolutely too. So a lot of the focus of my book too, for the most part, is secular in content. So a lot of the stories that they obviously everyone in the Middle Ages, you know, had was influenced by Christianity in the medieval West, but these stories kind of more feature kind of secular content too. So it's not written by monks for monks in a monastery too. We have kind of writers such as Chaucer too and Gower. They're reading to a courtly audience too, so they're reading to a court of the king. So Chaucer and Gower would be writing to Richard II in the late 14th century. Kind of interesting in that regard too. But then you get kind of religious poems too. So there's one poem that I look at. It's between Morienus and Merlin, and they swear on Christ too. So it has kind of a religious aspect to it as well too. And that's really interesting too. And I think that's part of the way of legitimizing it too, is to kind of connect to Christian allegory. So the search for kind of Christianity as being a search for the kind of philosopher's stone too. There's an interesting connection there too. So my book looks at more of the secular examples too, but obviously there's a lot of religious examples too. And this kind of comes up too in a lot of the Latin prose at the time too. But I was kind of interested in the secular examples because this links to the kind of exemplar tradition that we see. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the exemplary poems are more secular in content too. And I think too, the secular content can reach a wider audience too, not just kind of a monkly audience or a cloistered audience. You can have, you can reach people from across the different social classes and orders.
Why is Dante Algier canon to alchemical texts, if he is at all, and who else is canon?
So Dante is, he wrote the Divine Comedy, and in Inferno, there's a really interesting canto. I forget the exact canto, but in the canto, so we have Dante and Virgil's guiding him through hell, and he sees the alchemists, and you'd think, why are these alchemists in hell too? And what's interesting is they're compared to people who are guilty of fraudulence too. And you know, sneaky thing about Dante, he always bases on real characters. So some of these characters are real life. There's one character, it's quite gruesome actually, and he's kind of constantly scratching himself, and he has scabs on himself, and he's still scratching himself too. So alchemy is kind of painted in a bad light in this way. But it's a really interesting depiction too, and it's actually pretty far into hell too. So I mean, to be an alchemist in Dante's eyes was kind of not a very good thing. And we also see, as I mentioned in Jean de Meung, Romance of the Rose too, we have alchemy as kind of the ape of nature. So this is kind of a famous phrase, the ape of nature. It's not the kind of genuine replication of nature. So he has a little segment on that too. And then we have Chaucer's tale, as I mentioned, and then John Gower's section on alchemy too. And his section on alchemy comes under laborers and discoverers too. So it's interesting with John Gower as he pictures alchemy as kind of a lost art. It's kind of seen as the perfect model for labor, but it's kind of a bit of paradoxical because nobody can really attain it because the information needed to attain alchemy has been lost. But he does say that the ancient alchemists, a lot of the Arabic alchemists actually were successful with their art. Obviously, that's not true. But those are kind of some of the big names with alchemy at that time. Also, in Piers Plowman, Langlin writes about alchemy too. So he has a little section devoted to alchemy too. But it's quite it's in the B text, I think, the A text or the B text. And he doesn't really write favorably about alchemy too. So a lot of these authors too, not always great views, but I wanted to kind of go beyond the kind of canon a little bit as well too, and look at some of the anonymous stuff, because a lot of times, you know, there were people who believed alchemy that could work, and they did at this time too for a lot of them, and the anonymous texts show that they believed that alchemy could indeed work, or it indeed had some kind of validation for life skills. You know, you could be a better person, or you could teach your child these values too, the values of Christ too. So even if alchemy doesn't work, you still have, you know, these Christian values or whatever the case may be.
What medieval writers were part of the banned book club?
I don't know if there was like a banned book club as such, but I think a lot of them were kind of looked down upon too. This really happened a lot of times too. They didn't really have the Inquisition as much with alchemy at this time too, but it was banned. I don't know if there was a banned book club so much. I think there was just more of the decretals that were being put in place too. So in the 13th century, you had Pope John II's decretal against alchemy, and then you had Henry IV also had a decretal against alchemy, and then I think Henry V also had a decretal against alchemy too. So none of the books were really banned. I think also it's important to keep in mind that some of these authors, such as Chaucer, they kind of had a less than favorable view on alchemy too. So I think that would kind of save them from the banned book club too. There was one author that I did write about, John of Rupicissa. He was really interesting, and he said that alchemy was the world. He was convinced that the world was going to end, and that alchemy was going to redeem humankind, and they threw him in jail a couple times. So I think he'd probably be a good candidate for the banned book club. And he writes about the fifth element, so the quintessence. This is important in Aristotelian thought too, and this also kind of trickles into the early modern period too. But I think John would probably be on the banned book club for sure.
What archives did you do most of your research in, and were you reading in the original Latin in some cases?
Yeah, so my book has sections in Latin, and it also has sections in Old French and some in Italian too. So I had to kind of really navigate with the languages, and then also Middle English too. And Middle English can be a challenge even if you're a native speaker too. So thankfully, I was based at Durham University in Northern England, and Durham University has a great amount of resources, but unfortunately, they don't have that many medieval alchemical texts in the library too. So I did do a research trip to Cambridge University, the Wren Library at Trinity College. Wonderful experience too, and I was looking at the text concerning Albertus Magnus and the Queen of Elves. And then I also went to the British Library, and this is where they have Elias Ashmole's original Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum, and the edition of Churl of the Bird that I was looking at. So the British Library had a lot of good resources for that too, and they also have the Sloane collection too. It's been a while since I was working on my PhD, but thankfully nowadays a lot of the alchemical manuscripts have been digitized too. There's a lot of catalogs available online too, and so those were quite useful for my purposes as well.
What made John Gower's Confessio Amantis so influential?
John Gower's Confessio Amantis was really influential. So in its time, it was kind of it's kind of a story within a story too, because you have this kind of mourning lover, and he turns to Amans, the confessor, and the confessor teaches him about all the different types of teaches them about love and kind of sins in all their different forms too. So this is really helpful for the exemplary tradition too. He's kind of seen as a contemporary of Chaucer. He doesn't always get the same accolades as Chaucer because when we go into the Renaissance period and the Victorian period, a lot of people, you know, there was the Reformation and the Luther and everything, the Protestantism. And, you know, a lot of his stuff was seen as kind of moldy Catholic tales, which is too bad because actually there's a lot of meaning in there too. And what's interesting with Gower is he's taking a lot of classical stories. So Jason, the Golden Fleece, you know, Medusa, and he fits them within that framework of sin, to kind of use them as examples of, you know, don't do this and don't do this, how to be the perfect lover too. So it's a really beautiful collection of stories too. Sometimes he has his own versions of it too. Elias Ashmole thought he had an alchemical version of Jason the Golden Fleece, which isn't true. The alchemical section is actually interesting too, because some people argue that it's not a true exemplar because it's not its own narrative, but it's technically a narrative within a narrative. So I argue that it is in fact its own narrative.
Are literary researchers entering a new paradigm, so to speak, or are they reading the same text in the same ways as they have been?
I think there's a lot more interest these days in the relationship between literature and science too. I think people are realizing that, you know, the value of kind of interdisciplinarity too. The project that I'm part of right now too, I work with computer scientists and linguists and computational linguists and all kinds of different education sector too. So I think, you know, that I think they're starting to see new approaches to literature too, to kind of go beyond their kind of comfort zone too. Obviously it's quite hard for, you know, literary scholars to kind of gather empirical data too. That's one thing I'm struggling with too, but I think, you know, there's a symbiosis between them too. I think, literary scholars can show, you know, scientists have these, all these amazing stories to tell, but sometimes when they're writing too or trying to express ideas, it's hard for them to kind of convey them successfully. So we can show, literary scholars can show scientists how to do science better too. And I think scientists can show literary scholars the actual science too. So that's something I'm really interested in with this text too, that kind of symbiosis between those.
And what about playwrights? Does Shakespeare count as an alchemical writer?
Yes, I would say so. So Shakespeare comes a bit later. We also have Ben Jonson writing The Alchemist too. That's a really influential play. And that's kind of really stab in the gut too. So he makes fun of everything alchemical too. There's a couple plays in which alchemy appears for Shakespeare, Julius Caesar, and I think Timons of Athens, but and also some of his sonnets. But they're kind of used more metaphorically too, and more to indicate transmutation or change than kind of anything too meaningful too. But I think Ben Jonson's The Alchemist is a really important text too, and he kind of just takes a stab at it too. You know, he makes fun of the people practicing alchemy, the art itself too. A lot of his characters in the play all have kind of ridiculous names too, and they're kind of, you know, they have those kind of sketchy alchemists practicing in the laboratory, probably inspired by Chaucer's Canon's Yeoman's Tale. But yeah, so yeah, there's a lot of kind of exciting things happening with plays. We also have Robert Greene's play, about Friar Bungay and Friar Bacon too, and this is based on the kind of medieval alchemy too. And this is a play where they make this kind of talking head, and the talking head actually speaks, and then it gets kind of divinely destroyed. So lots of kind of cool stuff happening in the Renaissance with that too. And again, they're kind of hearkening back to the medieval past. Not always favorably, they kind of make fun of it quite a bit too, but I mean, it just shows that the ideas of medieval alchemy were still in people's minds too. In the kind of crossover between the medieval and the Renaissance too, you have the Macquer poets. These are Scottish poets too, who are also writing about alchemy as well too, and they write about it probably not as in depth or as in as detail as Jonson or kind of Chaucer, but I mean, it's still worth investigating, I think.
And what about giants? Why do they feature so well in stories like Canterbury Tales or the Sir Gawain and the Green Knight tale?
Giants. Well, they don't really fit in with alchemy so much. It's more about the kind of the idea of the homunculus, I suppose. I haven't encountered too many giants in alchemical writing to, I think in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, it's an interesting one because you have this kind of character who comes in this feast and he's just so otherworldly. He's just so weird, you know, coming into this court and he's dressed in green. He's this giant man. He cuts off his own head too. It just shows the kind of subversiveness of that kind of world. And I guess basically he's from Wales, you know, so the English have this kind of stigma about Wales at the time. But yeah, giants don't figure into the alchemical texts so much, as at least the ones I have encountered too. But I guess if they do appear too, they'd probably be some form of allegory, I would think.
And what physical features are common in alchemists from your readings? What do they look like and how are they presented?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Chaucer probably gives the most vivid description of alchemists too. It's not a very favorable description of alchemists. So the alchemists that he describes, they're kind of lead in the face too. So that's not a good sign too, because as we know with modern science, lead is poisonous. But they're kind of lead in the face for spending so much time in the lab too, and they stink. They smell like sulfur, and they're dealing with dealing with shit all the time. So the shit explodes and they get covered in it. The one that's depicted in the Canon's The Omen's Tale is quite a caricature, I guess, of alchemy too. And he can't see properly either. He has really bad eyesight from the furnace. The furnace is kind of compared to a hell. That's probably the richest description, I guess, we get of alchemists. Obviously, we have alchemists depicted in art a little bit more too. But that's more into the Renaissance too. But obviously, you know, it wasn't always that bad too. Chaucer's just very kind of subversive as a storyteller. But if we look at kind of other descriptions too, you know, we have people practicing in a lab. But we don't have too many fictional descriptions of alchemists at this time.
And what do you want readers to look out for in your book, Alchemy and Exemplary Poetry? Anything else that you haven't already mentioned?
Yeah, well, I hope it benefits people who are interested in kind of learning more about medieval sciences and its connections to literature, too. I think it'll appeal to kind of not only people who are interested in medieval science, but also kind of contemporary readers as well too, because I think, you know, if you're a chemist too and you want to know more about the kind of the roots of alchemy too, there's a lot there to learn from. I think for literature students too, they can think about ways that we can connect, have dialogues with science too, how we can reach out to scientists, and also how scientists can present their ideas in kind of more efficient narrative ways too. So I mean, even if alchemy doesn't work, I think there's a lot metaphorically to appreciate from kind of these approaches to literature too. And I think it's nice to look just beyond the artistic scope too. I think it's nice to approach from a science perspective. I mean, I think there's a lot of exciting things happening right now too with the history of alchemy and science too. I'm part of the Society for the History of Alchemy and Chemistry, and you know, they're doing all kinds of research too. There's a lot of excavations taking place, so we're still learning a lot about the history of alchemy too. And I mean, we'll still probably encounter more you know, stories about that. And one thing I was really excited about with my research is finding all those kind of alchemical recipes and anonymous dialogues too, because a lot of people, they know about Chaucer, they know about Gower, maybe even John Lydgate, but they probably don't know about, you know, Albertus Magnus and the Queen of Elves. And these are kind of some narratives that I want to draw more attention to analyze, you know, and hopefully, you know, it'll get more people interested in kind of seeking out those alchemical manuscripts and kind of analyzing them, seeing what they mean, how they kind of open the window into kind of 15th century scientific practice or pseudo-scientific practice, and just gives us an idea of what that kind of life was like too. And maybe we can learn from that, you know, in modern science and modern narratives too, ways of kind of conveying storytelling and etc.
Are you holding any meet and greets or in-person seminars or lectures? How can people reach out to you if that's what they want to do?
Well, I always like hearing from people, so I'm not sure if I'm doing any book events or anything yet too, although I would be keen, but I would welcome people to email me too, or to talk to me on Twitter or Instagram, I guess. And I'm always happy to talk about my research too, or to talk about alchemy too. I'm really interested in early modern alchemy. I'm also interested in the history of chemistry too. I come from a more literary background, so I'm not a full scientist, but I'm always interested in kind of learning new things too. And I have presented on early modern alchemy too. So I gave a presentation last year in Wales on there's a Welsh alchemist called Thomas Vaughan, and he had a twin brother called Henry Vaughan, who's probably more famous than him. But his wife Rebecca was an alchemist too, which is really rare in the early modern period. And what it's even rare is that he actually treated her as his equal. She was his lab partner, assistant, and she was very involved with this process too. And I thought that was really interesting too. So that really made me think about alchemy. So I'm interested in all aspects too. I'm interested in kind of astronomy, astrology too. Obviously, I more astronomy than astrology, but in the Middle Ages, they weren't seen as quite different. They were kind of interchangeable in a lot of ways, too. And I'm also interested in kind of, just looking at the Middle Ages, you know, rather than as the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, as kind of, I think as Seb Falk once said, the Light Ages in his new book. So yeah, I welcome kind of any email inquiries too, and you'll probably hear more if there's any kind of book launches or anything.
New Books Network and your host, Nathan Moore, thank Dr. Curtis Runstedler for completing an episode about his book, Alchemy and Exemplary Poetry in Middle English Literature. Stay up to date on all things NBN by subscribing or visiting our website.
Thanks so much, man.